two men sit facing each other, not just separated by a table, but by large and stout bars. They look through a mesh at each other, each pitying the other because of his plight. From this brief description, you don't know which one, or if both, are in prison. One may be in a large room where he can walk about freely, and the other in a small room. One may be in a large room where there are plenty of obstacles that he can pick his way through and around and over. The other may be in a room with very little that can be seen. But which side is the prison? Nothing seems to be there that could indicate which is freedom and which is slavery. Western world prides itself on being the free society, the slaves of no man, where each person is able to climb the ladder of success. The Brits keep singing that they will never ever be slaves, and the Americans keep reminding themselves of the log cabin to White House climb. Australians, you really shouldn't. We are no longer a convict settlement. In the last 20 or so years, one of the phrases that has been used as a positive, I will towards negative in others, is that we have become a permissive society. A society where you are permitted to do as you please. A society where there is freedom, not restriction. Permission, not regulation. And yet, we see that freedom can bring with it a terrible train of slavery. The pattern of freedom that has been given to us in our literature through successive governments is leading now successive governments to take restrictions on the production, sale, distribution of literature. Each time claiming that they never knew, they never thought, it never occurred to them that anybody would produce the kind of degenerate, inhuman filth that is now the profit motive of many people. The child pornography, the videos that not even our local state government can stomach, shows the capacity for people, when given total freedom, to put themselves in such a bondage and slavery. We have a society where every person is free to achieve whatever success they wish, and yet we see workaholics, neurotics, compulsive, continually pushing forward further and further to achieve greater and greater. They're not quite sure what, but it lies there ahead of them. The competitiveness which drives people to create wonderful industries and marvellous educational institutions and all kinds of good and great things in hospitals and slowly eat away and destroy people and their families and their lives as they find themselves in bondage to the clock, or is it to the prestige, or is it to success itself, or is it to life? But we have in our dislike of slavery forgotten some of its benefits, especially some of the benefits that can flow from living under a kind master, under the benevolence of a father who may care, under the master who has laid down his life for his servants. That to live in bondage to Jesus brings a freedom which those outside cannot see. A freedom from Satan, a freedom from sin, a freedom from death, a freedom from self. A freedom that is hard to explain and describe, but gives a freedom to live, to love, to life itself. There is a great freedom in a particular kind of slavery. People see Christians and feel sorry for our restricted, non-permissive lifestyle, and yet they are amazed and often jealous of our easy and happy, pleasant experience of life. Envious of a lifestyle that seems less complicated and more satisfying. A friend was telling me even this morning of family members who always criticises and jokes and ridicules and mocks, but who of recent times, when a few under the belt so that he can speak an honest truth, admitted that he really respected and admired enormously. There's that terrible ambivalence about it, where there can be this disparagement of living under such kinds of circumstance, and yet inward envy that people can have it so good. And so who is in prison? Who is on which sides of the bars? The unbeliever sees our slavery, but desperately tries to ignore our freedoms. The more he sees his freedoms, the more he enjoys his freedoms, he is frustrated by his own self-centered slavery. In Galatians chapter 5, verse 1, Paul appeals to the Galatian Christians to retain their freedom. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm, then, and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. This is the key verse of tonight's passage. It is a verse well worth marking and learning. It is an important verse in the whole context of the Epistle of the Galatians, the context of Christian living. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then, and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. Before we see how this appeal applies to us, we must understand it properly, because it's the kind of phrase that could be used in any jingoistic campaign, couldn't it? Freedom is that kind of word that no one is going to argue against. And so when you rally the troops, you call out, here is the way to freedom, and they line up and fall into any kind of slavery that will get them to freedom. Freedom, in its context, must be studied before we jump onto the bandwagon. And so we're going to look first at Paul and the Galatians, and then at Abraham's sons, their slavery and their freedom, before we come to Paul's appeal for us. So let us look at Paul and the Galatians. The revision comes in at this point of tonight's address. Constant drip, drip, drip. By the end of the series, I hope that you will remember for the rest of your life what the Galatian epistle is about. So hang on, learn the lesson again. Do a quick run through on the history first. Paul, on his first missionary tour, called into the cities of Galatia, the area we might call Turkey. There he preached the gospel to the Jews and the Gentiles, and saw people, both Jews and Gentiles, converted. God's Spirit worked in their lives as they heard of the gospel of the grace of Christ, of the Christ crucified, and they believed. But shortly afterwards, when Paul left, some bewitching advisers came to Galatia. These people were bewitching the Christians with their advice about the necessity for Christians to obey the law. They were claiming that to be genuine Christians, in fellowship with the apostles in Jerusalem, you had to be obedient to the law as well as having faith in Jesus Christ. And so they called upon the Gentile, the non-Jewish Christians, to be circumcised in order to place themselves under the law, because circumcision was the great sign of being under God's contract, under God's law. Upon hearing this, Paul has written this letter, this very strongly worded letter, appealing to the Galatian Christians not to turn away from the gospel that he has preached. You'll notice it there in chapter 3, verse 1, who has bewitched you? You'll see it back in chapter 1, verse 6, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you by the grace of God. It's an appeal not to turn away. Appealing to them, chapter 5, verse 1, to stand firm. Not to turn back. Not to give away the freedom that Christ has won. Not to submit again to a yoke of slavery. So much of our letter hinges on the relationship between Paul and the Galatians and the troublers. Chapter 4 starts to spell out this with some personal anecdotes that he and his writers knew about, but which we are a little on the outside of. In chapter 4, not starting, rather the section we're looking at tonight. And so in verses 13 to 14, we read that his initial visit, the Galatians warmly received Paul. I pick up verse 12. I plead with you, brothers, become like me, for I have become like you. You do done me no wrong. As you know, it was because of an illness that I first preached the gospel to you. Even though my illness was a trial to you, you did not treat me with contempt or scorn. Instead, you welcomed me as if I were an angel of God, as if I were Christ Jesus himself. Initially, it was very warm and welcoming. We don't know the details of the sickness. There are many suggestions, but we don't know really. We don't know what handicap it was and why it led him to preach the gospel there and why and how they coped with it, but presumably from this it was something that was unpleasant for them to deal with, and yet they accepted him. But now Paul is worried that the Galatians have been stirred up to be anti-Paul, to be opposed to him. Have I, verse 14 of chapter 4, verse 16 of chapter 4, become your enemy? Verse 17, these troublers, they want to alienate you from us. And so Paul is worried about the opposition that is coming to him, that is being set up by these troublers. And there's certainly, the troublers have sown at least some misunderstandings and doubts in the minds of the Galatian Christians, even if not enmity coming to its full fruition. And so Paul feels that he has to defend himself. We see it back in chapter 1, verse 1, where he makes this big defense of his apostleship, not from men, nor by men, but by Jesus Christ. You see it in verse 10. Am I now trying to win the approval of men or of God? As if somebody's been saying that's what Paul's like. He's always trying to get people's approval. He's not a man who will stand firm for the truth. He's always courting people's affection. And so in verse 10 has that indication. It seems as if Paul has been accused of preaching their false gospel himself, the gospel of circumcision. So you see in chapter 5, verse 11, 5:11, brothers, if I am still preaching circumcision, why am I still being persecuted? I don't preach circumcision. You know I don't, but it's as if they have been suggesting that Paul really preaches circumcision. He says, I don't preach circumcision, but I'm not against it either, because circumcision's neither here nor there. And here's the whole problem that Paul has. He doesn't want to oppose circumcision. It's a matter of indifference. He doesn't want to say you mustn't be circumcised. It's a matter of indifference. But at the same time, he doesn't want to preach that you must be circumcised. It's wrong to... And so he's caught in a bind here. This morning I was having a chat to a bloke about schools. And I was being compared to a fellow minister. And he said, well, this fellow minister is all for private schools. Whereas you, Philip, I'm for public schools. My kids go to public schools, these other ministers' kids go to private schools. He says, now, what am I supposed to do about my kids? Is there a particular view that you hold? Now, there is a problem, you see. I'm now being put in a position of being not only pro-public school, but anti-private school. That's not the case, you see. My problem is I'm not anti-private school at all. I believe in having an independent system at the same time as the public system, because I think there's a good times and occasions when it's a good thing to go. But because I think whether you go to private school or public school is neither here nor there, and because I've actually chosen to go to public school, I can be misunderstood to be anti-private school. Very easy misunderstanding, isn't it? That's, on a much more significant and important subject, the kind of misunderstanding Paul's in. Whether you're circumcised, whether you're uncircumcised, doesn't matter. And so he doesn't circumcise Gentiles, except he does. He does circumcise Timothy. There's an advantage in that somewhere along the line. Because he's like that, people misunderstand him. Some are saying, he won't circumcise anybody. He's against circumcision. He's preaching against circumcision. He's saying, no, I'm not preaching against circumcision. I had Timothy circumcised. So others are saying, I had Paul. He's for circumcision. He's all for it. He's saying, no, I'm not for it either. It's neither one thing nor the other. And the misunderstandings are growing in the Galatians. And they can say, you see, Paul's just a man pleaser, isn't he? When he's with the Jews, he's all pro-circumcised circumcision. When he's with the Gentiles, he's all anti-circumcision. He's not for truth. He changes depending on the company he keeps. See the kinds of misunderstandings that are building in the Galatian context. And with people who are hostile to Paul, who are anti-Paul, working to undermine his apostolic authority, they seem to have good, fertile ground to work on. So Paul is explaining his desires in these relationships. For the Galatians, he desires them, chapter 4, verse 12, to become like him. In verses 19 and 20, you see the perplexed state his mind is in about them. Let me read verses 19 and 20. My dear children, for whom I am again in the pains of childbirth until Christ is formed in you, how I wish I could be with you now and change my tone, because I'm perplexed about you. His actual relationship to them is the warmth of motherhood. He's bringing them to birth and he's troubled by the troubles they are going through, by the pains and sufferings, by the difficulties. And he'd like to be there to use just the right tone. If I've ever written a letter, it's always hard, isn't it, when it's a serious letter, to know just exactly how to say it. Because you can't work out how exactly it will be read by someone 1 week later on the other side of the world, in a different context, when the heat of the controversy is now gone. He'd love to be there with them. Mind you, his desires for the troublers are really something, aren't they? They will pay for trying to mislead the sheep of God. Paul wishes upon them in chapter 5, verse 12, one of the passages of Scripture I've never met anybody who uses as a memory text. As for those agitators, I wish they would go the whole way and castrate themselves, in case you don't know what the word emasculate means. They want to fiddle on the around. They want to have everybody, all the men of the community circumcised. Well, I wish they'd slip with their knife when they're doing themselves. Do a proper job of it, is the kind of attitude. It is fairly unfriendly, you could say, at this point. The reason why Paul takes such a strong stance is because theology is in the centre of this controversy. It's really a theological matter that is involved. They are not just disturbing a club. They are theologically false and, in fact, intolerable. For Paul had seen a group of slaves freed, and now these troublers were selling them back into slavery. The slavery theme is seen throughout this epistle, beginning in chapter 1, verse 4, where Paul speaks of Jesus rescuing them from the present evil age. Or you see it in chapter 3, verses 22 to 25, which Peter spoke to us last week about. The Scripture declares the whole world, 3:22, is a prisoner of sin, so that what was promised being given through the faith in Jesus might be given to those who believe. Before this faith came, we were held as prisoners by the law, locked up until faith should be revealed. So the law was put in charge to lead us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. Now that faith has come, we are no longer under the supervision of the law. Or again, down in chapter 4, verse 1, what am I saying? What I am saying is that as long as the heir is a child, he is no different from a slave, although he owns the whole estate. He is subject to guardians and trustees until the time set by his father. So also, when we were children, we were in slavery under the basic principles of the world. Slavery has been a way in which he has been describing it throughout this epistle, that we are in bondage to sin. We're in bondage particularly to sin by the law. For what the law does is it declares that we are sinners. It declares to us God's wrath on our sin. It declares to us our condemnation, so that we're in bondage to the very basic principles of the world. Or again, verse 8, formerly of chapter 4, formerly when you did not know God, you were slaves to those who by nature are not gods. But now that you know God, or rather are known by God, how can you How is it that you are turning back to these weak and miserable principles? Do you wish again to be enslaved by them all over? You are observing special days and months and seasons and years, and I fear that somehow I've wasted my effort on you. You were in bondage. Bondage to what? There's a whole variety of things hinted at here. Bondage to sin. Bondage to the law which condemned you because of your sinfulness. Bondage to death. Bondage to the present evil age and the world and the powers and principalities that are at work, prompting you and leading you and controlling you in evil. Bondage to idolatry, to things that were not gods at all. Bondage to the religious practices of idolatry and evil powers and principalities and spirits, to the religious practices of special days and months and seasons and years, the astrological patterns, the feast days, the fast days, the Friday the 13th superstitious days, all the days that religion practices to hold people in bondage, the days when you're not allowed to eat and the days in which you're not allowed to this and that, and so it goes on. All religions practice it. You were in slavery. But the great gospel is the great but. But Christ has freed you from that. Freed you from sin, freed you from the law, freed you from the present evil age and the powers and principalities that so dominated it. Freed you from the rules and regulations by which men hope to get to God. Freed you from the restrictions and the bondages that go with the powers and principalities and the basic principles of the world. Freed you from the idols. Christ has freed you. When faith came, you were no longer under the supervision of the law, no longer under the guardian, under the tutor. He redeems you. He has purchased you out of the slavery so that you can become sons. You are being freed to be known by God in chapter 4, verse 9. We do not really live much in a world in which there are the literal slaves of the ancient world. We do not even now live in a society where there is the upstairs and downstairs community of the servants and the masters. We live in a society where that doesn't appear to be the case anymore, although in the workplace there's the executive dining room suite and the rest isn't there. But at the home front, that is not so much the scene. And so the enormous social distinction between those who cannot enter into the main rooms of the house unless they're on an errand and are bowing and scraping, as opposed to those, even though they be the littlest toddlers in the whole building, who are members of the family who can run in freely, scribble on the walls, kick their shoes off on the floor, leave them lying about, and have grown men and women come and pick them up and clean the floor and say, sir. And the distinction between the slave in the family and the son of the family is almost lost to us, although it's not hard to understand, is it? You were the slaves. Slaves to a world that was thoroughly contaminated by power and evil. And you have been freed. Freed to become members of the family, to become the cherished son, daughter of the master of the household. You have been freed from slavery. But what he is wrestling with is that they are just about to lose their freedom again, having gained it at the cost of God's son being executed. Wasn't a cheap freedom. Having gained it by God sending his son into the world to be crucified, they're now about to throw it away. See it there, verses 8 to 10 of chapter 4. Formerly, when you did not know God, you were slaves to those who by nature are not gods. But now that you know God, or rather, what's even more important and fantastic, are known by God. You saw I had some words in there, didn't you? How is it that you are turning back to those weak and miserable principles? Do you wish to be enslaved by them all over again? You're observing special days and months and seasons and years. I fear that somehow I've wasted my efforts on you. Here is the great danger, the running back into religious observances as the way to getting right with God, the way to finding acceptance. And so the challenge of chapter 5, it really is freedom that is lost. For having challenged them to continue to be free, look at verse 2. Mark my words, he says. I, Paul, tell you that if you, chapter 5, 2, if you let yourselves be circumcised, Christ will be of no value to you at all. Again, I declare to every man who lets himself be circumcised that he is obligated to obey the whole law. And you, who are trying to be justified by the law, have been alienated from Christ. You've fallen away from grace. By faith, we eagerly await the Spirit, the righteousness for which we hope. And so it goes on. You turn back to circumcision. You turn back to circumcision, and you will turn back to the law, because that's what it means. You turn back to the law, then you will be seeking to get yourself right with God. You turn back to seeking to get yourself right with God, you are throwing away Jesus and his execution on your behalf. You throw away Jesus and his execution on your behalf, and you're lost. You're doomed. And the very law for which you have sacrificed Christ, the very law will condemn you. For God's law does not say you are all right with him. God's law says you are totally wrong with him. You've taken on the law to condemn yourself. The loss is very great. But you see the problem again? It's all caught up in this little thing, circumcision. He's saying you must not be circumcised. Now, you can miss the point fairly easily at this point, can't you, and say, okay, no circumcisions at all. Which means that most of the Australian male population over about 45 are all lost, because the medical practices of that generation are all circumcised as babies, out of fashion now, so a certain age group below about 10, they're nearly all saved. It's not circumcision itself. It's circumcision as the symbol of taking upon yourself the law of God. You take upon yourself the law of God, that's what it really is, of which circumcision is just a sign, then you are ditching Jesus as the way to God. And you're saying, I'm going to do it myself. That is what Paul is so fighting against. Paul then turns to one of the most unusual arguments in chapter 4, verses 21 to 31. One of the most unusual arguments. He says, you who want to be under the law, what does the law say? Here is an argument for law keepers, a lawyer's argument. Remember, the word law in the Old Testament means the whole first five books, and so he then gives you a bit that we don't think is very legalistic. Tells you the story about Abraham and his two sons. Let me just give you a reminder of the narrative for a few moments. We read it a bit in the Old Testament, didn't we? Abraham was promised to have a son, that through his son he'd have more descendants than the stars in the heaven or the sand on the shore. As he got older, he didn't have any sons, didn't have any daughters, in fact, didn't have, you guess it, children at all. Sarah, his wife, was blamed for it. I'm never quite sure why she was blamed for it. Could have been his problem. However, she provided for him her slave woman, Hagar. And then it showed that it wasn't Abraham's problem, because with Hagar, Abraham had a son, Ishmael. And so Abraham assumed that God's promises to him would take place through Ishmael. That through Ishmael, he'd become a grandfather and a great-grandfather and have all the stars of heaven type of children. But God said, no, it's not through Ishmael, it's going to be through Sarah. At that stage, Sarah was 90, and so she fell about the floor shrieking with laughter. So God said, well, you better call this boy, have a giggle. And so that's why he was called Isaac, which means in loose translation, have a giggle. He was, to put it mildly, the joke of the age. His parents were already in geriatric care when he was born. Ishmael made fun of Isaac when it came to Isaac's weaning. Ishmael then's about 16. But the kind of word that's talked about laughing at him is a word that we translate, and quite rightly, I think, to mock him. He mocked this small infant. And so Sarah, ever the mother, complained and insisted that her husband kicked Ishmael and the slave mother Hagar out of the family. And so she was chased out into the wilderness where God looked after her. Now, what is the point Paul wants to make it in chapter 4, verses 21 through to 31? He says, Abraham had two sons. One slave, Ishmael, born of a slave. And though temporarily an heir and a son, in fact, was always a slave. Figuratively, Paul says in verse 24, these things represent two covenants. The slave, Hagar, stands for the covenant, the contract of Mount Sinai, where the Ten Commandments and the great contract of God was given to the Jews. He stands for that because, or Hagar stands for that because she is in slavery with her children. Notice the present position of Israel as far as Jesus, as far as Paul is concerned. Israel and the Jews and Jerusalem are in slavery. That is their position. They are just like Ishmael, because although they are physically the sons of Abraham, they are not spiritually the sons of Abraham. They are not the ones of the promise. They are not the heirs. That is what the state of the present nation Israel is within the Scriptures. Can I say it again? And I will, because you need to grasp hold of it. The present state of Israel, the Jews of today, are like Ishmael, physical descendants of Abraham, born in slavery, not the children of the promise of Abraham. That is how Paul views them, the Jerusalem of today. I need to say it again and stress it for you because there is tremendous emphasis today in Christian community after Christian community of overestimating the importance of the state of Israel, of seeing the fulfillment of prophecies in the Old Testament in the state of Israel. And you have heard it recently, thanks to the ABC, who have gained tapes about the Americans and their conservative theology relating it to President Reagan. The whole idea of Armageddon taking place in this generation. And it is said, how accurately I do not know, it is said that President Reagan, the man who actually has his finger on the button, so to speak, believes that Armageddon, the end of the world, the last great battle, is going to take place in his lifetime. That is fairly scary, to put it mildly, if it is true. And how do they come to that position? Through people like Jerry Falwell? Well, because they believe that the present state of Israel is being set up in fulfillment to the prophecies, like the prophecies in Ezekiel. And having seen the present state of Israel as being the spiritual descendants of Abraham, they then look at all the prophecies of what is going to take place when Israel is set up. And away you go down a track which leads you to not just that, but a whole range of views of what is happening in the Middle East, what is happening with Russia and with America, with Gog and Magog and 100 other kinds of bits and pieces. And you find there's varieties in the conclusions that come. The Jehovah's Witnesses view it one way, The Seventh-day Adventists will view it in another way. The general dispensationalists in another way. Herbert W. Armstrong in yet another way. They've all got different views as to how the prophecies all fill out, but they all agree upon the one thing, that the present state of Israel is important. Whereas if they read Galatians 4, you will see that the present state of the people of Israel is that they are not the descendants of Abraham any more than Ishmael was. Certainly they're the physical descendants, but not the spiritual descendants. They are in slavery and bondage to the law, not right with God, but rather
cut off from God. That is their state.
There are two great errors that we see. One is to overemphasize Israel. The other, to which I warn you, although it's not nearly as common today, is to disregard Israel. And you'll get warning of that in Romans 9, 10 and 11. That the Israelite becoming a Christian is the true vine coming to fruition. When a Gentile becomes a Christian, we are a wild shoot that has been grafted in unnaturally. If God can cut out some of his true vine and cast it away for it doesn't bear fruit, be warned, he can also cut off the wild shoot that has been grafted in. And don't despise the true vine out of which you've come. Don't be anti-Jewish, because it's the very children of Abraham upon which we, the wild shoots, have been grafted in. And there are great times and periods, and it still may be true, but it's not so current in our community, of anti-Jewish sentiments, of people actually trying somehow to de-Judaize Jesus, as if he wasn't somehow 100% Jewish, completely and utterly, as if Christianity is not a Jewish religion. It is not just a Jew, it is the Jewish religion. Fundamentally, the Jewish. We are the true Jew. And cut ourselves off from Judaism. That's not such a problem. The overemphasis is the problem at the moment. They do not see what God has done to the plant, chopping off those who are in bondage, who reject their own Messiah. But Abraham had a second son, a free one, Isaac, born of a free woman, the son of a promise and inheritance. And Sarah stands for the new covenant. Our Jerusalem is the one that is above, the heavenly city. And we, like Isaac, are the children of promise, children of supernatural birth, children who are born under the power of the Spirit. And that's what Isaac is, you see. Here is a man born when his parents are old, too old. His parents are, as the scripture says, as good as dead. And they are. Most of us are around 90. If we get that far, we're as good as dead, aren't we? Here are a couple of people whose parents are as good as, a couple of people are as good as dead, and now they give life. How could it be? Only supernaturally. I mean, that's miracle category stuff, isn't it? So it is with you and I when we become Christians. By the Spirit of God, we who were dead in sin and trespasses, who are spiritually cut off from God, who without God and without hope, by the Spirit of God, we have been born again. We are the ones who, like Isaac, have gone through the supernatural birth, the spiritual birth of promise. And that is what makes us the true children of Abraham. We are the sons and daughters of Abraham. Paul points beyond this simple analogy of slavery and freedom to notice the interaction between the two children. Ishmael persecuted Isaac, mocked him. And so, says Paul, the slave people go on persecuting the spirit people, just as Ishmael did to the child of the promise. And so Ishmael and his mother were cut off from the inheritance, and so the slave, Hagar, and her children, the people of Israel today, are now cut off from their own inheritance. It's an incredible insult, this passage, to the Israelites. For it actually says, you are the Ishmaelites. You are not the descendants of Abraham. So Paul sees, even in his own persecution of Christians before he became a Christian himself, he sees in himself and in the work of the false brethren the same spirit of Ishmael, of slavery, hating those who have freedom. And he sees the same judgment, the same result. The two sons, one slave, one free. One the free will inherit. The other the slave will not inherit with the free, as he concludes at the end of chapter 4. Therefore, chapter 5, verse 1, we come to our text at last. It does arrive eventually. Therefore, it is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm and do not let ourselves, yet yourselves, be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. So much hangs on the Galatians' perception of freedom and slavery. Christ has acted. His act is that of setting us free. It's not he will set us free, he has set us free. How? By paying for our sins, by conquering the forces and powers of evil in the world, by overcoming the condemnation of the law, by a whole variety of ways, all which centre on his death, because it is in his death that he pays for our sin. It is in his death that he overcomes the condemnation of the law. It is in his death that he overcomes the powers of the evil one. It is in his death that he frees us to love and to serve God willingly and cheerfully, but frees us, because notice the aim of Christ. He has done this in order for us to live not in slavery, but in freedom. And so he says in chapter 5, verse 1 there again, notice it, it is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Funny phrase, isn't it? But grasp it. What has Christ set us free for? So that we may be free. He hasn't set us free so that we'll run back into bondage. Hasn't done that. I understand, although where I read this now, I'm completely forgotten. And so the details of it may be totally wrong, and you can come and correct me later. But the illustration works, whether the details are true or not. I understand that after the American Civil War, when men and women died in what was one of the most barbaric of the Western world's wars, it really was a horrendous war, the American Civil War. People really laid down their lives, and they laid it down on the slavery issue. And after many of those poor people were actually released and freed, a year or two later, living out in the free capitalistic system, many a slave returned back to the family estate and said, "Can we come back, because we were better off when we were slaves than now that we are free?" You wonder what people whose families had been destroyed by the war, men and women who had laid down their life for the sake of getting those slaves free, would have thought of slaves and then went back and put themselves into slavery. Freedom is for what Jesus has died. He has died that we may be free, not that we will run back into slavery. It's just like the people of Israel, though, isn't it? God sent the plagues to rescue them from the slavery of Pharaoh. That was the tremendous miracle of opening up the Red Sea so they can get through out, and provides food for them in the wilderness. And the whole way, they keep on saying, you know, the late night movies were better back in Egypt. Had great hamburgers down there. Can't really work out why we were wandering around in the desert, eating birds and this manna stuff. Water's fairly scarce here. It's good back there in Egypt. God has done this for us. He has done this tremendous miracle of freeing us. But we have this perversity which tends to think that back there it'll be better. It really is all right back there.
After all I got on back there.
And this desire to edge our way back.
For freedom as he done.
Notice the aim of Christ. It's for freedom. And so as Christians, we now have
a responsibility
to stand firm in our freedom, to maintain our freedom, not to let ourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery, not to place ourselves again under law,
not to place ourselves again under
the powers and principalities of evil,
not to place ourselves
again under the slavery for which Jesus has died. To return to the ritual of religion is to return to the restriction of slavery. So those of us who have been freed must stand firm and not be weakened, not be burdened.
Because look at the
dangers that he spells out in verses 2 to 4 of chapter 5, that is. Look at the dangers. If you go back, Christ will be of no value to you. If you go back,
you'll be obligated
to obey the whole law. If you go back, you will have fallen away from grace, from mercy. If you go back, you're lost, sinful and condemned, unforgiven,
and damned.
And damned.
People today are still slaves.
They still need to see the enslavement of others. The moralists do it to us, and the permissivists. Those who make rules and regulations on how you are to behave, they keep on laying them on other people, don't they?
Those who insist
on the great rule of everybody being free to do whatever they want to, they keep on laying upon us the need to be as degenerate as they are as well. Some even tonight here may still be in slavery, for they have never found the work of Christ in his death for them. They are still caught in sin and self-centeredness, still under the power of Satan, of whom they may be well aware,
of whom they may be oblivious.
Caught in habits and ways that indicate to them that they are thoroughly caught in that kind of slavery.
For those who are caught
in the slavery of materialism,
on the following
of the fashions and the fads,
and to the group pressure
to acquire more and more, the greed, the envy, the rivalry, the competitiveness, caught into a slavery. There are those who are tempted back to the slavery of religion and religious observances, who really think it's important which date of the year you have Easter, who really think it is important that you don't eat fish on a Friday, who think it really is important that you... And the slaveries and bondages of religious ritual, the practices within the history of Christendom, as well as outside, the poor, bedeviled slaves who are caught up in the Krishna movement, hour after hour chanting Hare Krishna as they push another bead along the string, 3-4 hours a day of having to rattle out this in the hope of somehow getting themselves into the new state, the upper state, the place where it is. Terrible bondage of standing chanting from one foot to the other, hour after hour, the same meaningless nonsense. Well, those poor people in the slavery of the mantra, sitting down in their transcendental meditation, pondering through a mantra which is actually the name of an Indian god, although it's not like that, it's just a scientific phrase, it's just a meaningless phrase, just provided you concentrate on it and you put your mind to it and you spend your time working on it, that somehow you will come into the wholeness of the spiritual reality. Those poor people locking their legs up in the appalling yoga positions. It's not a religion. Every book on yoga will tell you it's not a religion. Of course it's not. It's Hinduism. That's not a religion. That's a way of life. Yoga is to Hinduism as Billy Graham is to Christianity. It is Hindu evangelism. Only someone who knows nothing about Hinduism would ever think that Hinduism is going to preach a gospel like Billy Graham preaches a gospel. Hinduism is not rational like that. It is not a verbal word from God. It is a mystic experience. That if you put yourself into the slavery of discipline, you can put yourself into the touch with the supernatural world of demons and devils and evil spirits who rule in tyranny over you and capture you in an appalling slavery. A slavery of practice to a slavery of gods that are not God. But it's not just the bigoted Christian here attacking away at that. You can do it within Christianity too, can't you? You must do this, you must read your Bible every day, you must go to church every Sunday, you must say this, you must say those prayers, you've got to do it this way and that way. And if you've been through all these steps, then you'll be acceptable to God. You're still under law. You're still under rules. You're still under regulations. Seasons and new moons and past moons and old moons. I know, it's slavery. Christ has freed us from all those things. Freed us from sin by paying for it. Freed us from the law which condemns us. Freedom from the powers and principalities, the evil spirits that are at work in this world, continually holding man down. Freedom from our own selves and self-centeredness, which so dominates us. Freed us. Why? Why will you now turn back to law, to death, to condemnation? Stand firm as the sons of God. Stand firm in the freedom which Christ gives. They must view life from the perspective of freedom. A freedom he's going to go on and spell out in the freedom of the Spirit in the later in the chapter. A freedom to serve and love God and man. A freedom to give to others. A freedom to act and a freedom to live. Free from guilt and law and requirement. Free so that we can be accepted and know that we are accepted. So that we do not need to pretend because we are what we are. That is, loved by God and accepted in his family. But such a view will always be persecuted. Persecuted by those who are still under yoke. Persecuted by those who have got rules and regulations, rituals and religion, and who will be dissatisfied that we are so free, and who will be envious that we are so free. And they will say, it's not right that they are so free. They should be doing this and should be doing that. And as you move, and over the summer, many of us move into all kinds of holiday situations and camps and beach missions and across the whole range of society. And we talk about church, and you even mention the church you go to. People will criticize. I mean, if you're a Christian, you must go to church on Christmas Day, mustn't you? The fact that the 25th of December is picked up from pagan religion, the fact that nearly everything anybody ever does on Christmas Day is absolutely and utterly pagan, is a small consequence. You must go. I'll be in church on Christmas Day, I think. I'm travelling Christmas Day. I'm speaking at a convention that starts on Boxing Day down Melbourne, so I don't know whether I'll be on Christmas Day. I may not be in church on Christmas Day. And I nearly always am in church on Christmas Day because I like going to church every day of the week. But the only day off the government ever gives us to go to church is Sunday and Christmas Day, so that's the only days I can make it. Good Friday, I make it that day too. But if the government had given me more days off to go to church, I'd be in church every day. And I'm not in church because you're closer to God on Christmas Day than any other day. I doubt that very strongly. The amount of superstitious nonsense that goes on in the name of Christianity on Christmas Day, I would think that's the day in which God would keep me tempted to leave the world rather than enter into it. All that Germanic myth about the forest gods caught up in the trees that Prince Albert brought across to England and has now come down to Australia. We all gather around a pine tree, worshipping the gods of the forests. But we call it Christmas, and so that makes it all right, you see. It's all nonsense, all gobbledygook. But we're caught up in it. Now, don't get me wrong. Give out your presents, enjoy yourselves, eat hearty, live life. But just don't think it's Christian, that's all. What it is, it's got to do with it. It's an annual festivity of family getting together. And as Christians, we believe in families, and so that's a good thing to get together about, isn't it? It's just got nothing, very little to do with the death of Jesus on your behalf. And you see it reflected in the community, because really, for the community, it's the great way of hyping up the economy. And we know it. But yet, if you dare speak against Christmas, or worse still, speak against Santa Claus. Oh, rather have my tongue ripped out than mention that Santa Claus is the devil dressed up in red. Last thing we want to know is the truth about Santa Claus. You must never, ever speak against Santa. He is the ultimate good that brings all mankind under bondage and law. For he teaches us that good little children get the presents at the end, but naughty little children miss out, all in the name of God and Christianity. He is the devil's messenger for Christmas. But yet, I know at supper time tonight, someone will come to me who loves me, and many of you who don't love me won't come to me and say, you really shouldn't speak against Santa Claus. Because he's very important to little children. I say he's very important to little children. He makes sure that they never understand Christianity. That's how important he is. That's what he's about.
But he's religious. Couldn't you have goodwill towards him? My will towards him is much like Paul's will towards the travellers at the end of chapter 5.